it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome back to the Chelsea podcast. It's Chaz here and I'm joined as ever by the majestic Mooch. How are you, buddy?
Fine.
Yeah, well, you know.
It's just...
Obviously, it's all relative, isn't it? We've left it a few days after the match to do this recording for various reasons. And the Everton match, how are you shaping up after that?
It's tough. It's tough to realise that the season is probably, apart from maybe a cup, done. Do you know what I mean? It's, but you know, the disappointing thing is it's not like earlier defeats in the season where, you know, performances were great and we were like, okay, cool, we can see what's wrong, and it seems like we're a bit lost again, and it's kind of echoing last season, and it's just worrying.
It's a concern, and the ongoing injury list, etc. is also a concern, and obviously the longer term policies are also a concern. And I think the difference is, of course, is that this season we've started so optimistically after the pre-season and after a couple of good performances around that time. So we'll reflect back on the Everton game. First of all, I must introduce everybody to our guest this evening. We've got Daniel Childs from the Son of Chelsea podcast. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us.
No worries. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you're very welcome, mate. Tell us, for those who don't know, I'm sure we have some mutual listenership, but for those who don't know, tell us about your Chelsea background. When did it all start for you, and what does it all mean for you?
Yeah, so I mean, I basically come from a family who've grown up supporting Chelsea, grown up in the Chelsea area. So I pretty much grew up about 10 minutes from Stamford Bridge. So there was kind of no choice who I was going to be supporting. Then around the age of about 15, 16, which was close to 10 years ago now, I started my YouTube channel, Son of Chelsea. And it's pretty much grown from there. Next August will be the 10-year anniversary of starting it. And from there, I've done pieces for, I'm a regular contributor to the CFC UK fanzine. I've written for football.london. I've appeared on, you know, many podcasts, collab with people, and the YouTube channel itself has grown to over 30,000 subscribers. So yeah, it's kind of been a labor of love on that side. And I think, like a lot of people, you know, it's such a big part of my life. So it couldn't just be kind of a side thing. It's kind of, this passion has kind of morphed into a creative thing as well.
Sure. I mean, this is going to sound a glib thing to say, and it's not in any way, you know, don't take this the wrong way, but this must be one of the first times for you where things have probably seemed quite as bad as they are. Certainly the last 18 months anyway. Must be quite a new experience for a Chelsea fan, a dedicated Chelsea fan in their mid-20s.
True. But I think I'm quite fortunate that growing up, I have a family, you know, my dad, my granddad, my uncles, my brother grew up watching a different Chelsea.
Yeah.
So they would remind me, and I'd watch the old videotapes of Kerry Dixon and Peter Osgood and Pat Nevin, and I'd obviously see the best goals, the highlights. But
I'm not going to show my son the videotape of last season.
true. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that
unless he's done something really bad.
Or Southampton at home with under Graham Potter, I don't think is going to be on any highlight reel
playlists,
other than some sort of torture at Guantanamo Bay. But I think that it's for me it. I don't know, just my perspective on it is that doing the show, it sounds bad to say a distance from Chelsea because that's not the right way of framing it. But, you know, I'm not someone who goes off on rants about the club.
No.
So you have to kind of take a step back at times. And to be honest, I think that I'm someone who is really appreciative of seeing what I have as a Chelsea fan already. Like, I feel like I'm ahead in life. Chelsea could not win another trophy. I've seen things that 99.9% of football fans in the world will never see. So when you actually flip it like that, sure, at the moment we're all very frustrated and want to see that those good times return. But I mean, we're quite privileged, right? And I think some of my perspective of seeing football outside of Chelsea, going watching non-league games, having friends who support other clubs lower down the pyramid, seeing football across the world, you know, I think that you appreciate the privilege as Chelsea fans have had.
Yeah, I mean, and that comes over in your content, definitely. And, you know, we try very hard here to, and this is the one good thing about, you know, not sort of, we don't tend to record in the absolute immediate aftermath of the game, because if you'd have seen my Twitter feed and the WhatsApp messages between us, that, you know, we don't quite have that same temperate feel that we do when we finally come to record. So there was quite a lot of swearing. Anyway,
I did wine tasting on Sunday after the football, so that sort of was able to drown my sorrows and forget that football existed. So
yeah, a little bit of self-medication is always going to help, isn't it? Anyway, it's great to have you on. The game, I do tend to do this. I didn't for Manchester United because I thought that was an absolute shambles of a game. I when I look back at this game again, I felt there was less awful about it than I thought at the time while watching first time. However, it was another one of those games which we sort of thought we'd put behind us, where we huffed and puffed and we had some moments and actually probably, probably had the better of the game, certainly in terms of possession. But, you know, I'm not sure we really looked terribly like scoring. I'm not sure at any point we looked like we were going to take the game by the scruff of the neck. Would you agree with that?
True. I think that there was a reality, a harsh reality of that game of feeling very much like last season. I mean, one of the things that made me more optimistic earlier in the season, so like after the Aston Villa defeat, after the Nottingham Forest defeat, sure, those games were irritating, but, you know, and you looked at the quality of chances that we were making under Pochettino. One of the things that I think I've clung sort of onto the most so far this season, and some people roll their eyes when you bring this up, but like, XG, for instance, has been a lot higher under Mauricio Pochettino. Or just, if don't even have to talk about XG, you could just, in the eye test, we have been a team that looks like can create better quality opportunities.
100%.
My frustration with Sunday was it felt like the worst under Thomas Tuchel. It felt like the worst under Graham Potter. It did have that very much, especially when the first goal went in for Everton. It was back to February, January of this year, where a light breeze takes the team out and you have this crushing belief and kind of certainty that the moment we go 1-0 down, it's effectively game over. And to be honest, I think the evidence so far this season is actually, I haven't felt that way about this group of players. And I think that's the most soul crushing thing. When you look at the Man City game, I think that's the best example we have of how many times the team responded to adversity in that particular game. Agreed. And then a few weeks later, we see them at Man United, we see them at Everton. And to be so blunt and to look so just heads went down, and it just felt an inevitability that Chelsea were not going to walk away of anything. And that's a real shame.
Well, I don't think there'd be any disagreement on that from either of us. But, Meech, that being the case, why do you think we've taken that backward step? Because we did have that, you know, we did have that little run of games, two or three games, where actually we looked like we were getting it together. We looked like we were making more opportunities. You know, we took on some of the better teams in, all right, it started to go again against Newcastle, but we took on a couple of the better teams in the division, and we, you know, we looked well worth our points or 3 points that we took away from them. So can you see, Mooch, where the backward step has come?
I can only put it down to a lack of motivation from the team when you're not playing against the big boys. Do you know what I mean? When we were playing against City, everyone kind of upped their game. It seemed like, okay, cool. We know we're going to have to knuckle down to sort of eke out a result or stay in the game here. Newcastle, I don't feel like, I just feel like, you know, against Everton, we kind of were expecting it and it didn't come. And then when the goal went in, it was panic stations.
Sorry, mate.
No, go, come.
I mean, we've said, haven't we, obviously there are teams that are, you know, very much play in their own half and try and score on the break against us, and we have trouble breaking them down. And that's been the case, you know, through the course of the season. But as Daniel said, you know, it did feel to me like we had some better chances. You know, we were creating better chances in those games than we did in the Everton game. And I mean, and in the Manchester United game, and you'd like to think that players would be motivated for a game like that. We were absolutely all over the place.
Yeah,
we hardly had that, you know, that was sort of one moment of Cole Palmer brilliance aside, we were absolutely dire in that game. Let's have a look. I mean, the starting lineup was interesting, apart from anything else. You know, he left out four players who've been regular. Three of the players certainly have been regular starters. And it was slightly odd that he chose that game to leave out Thiago Silva, Sterling and Jackson in particular, although I think probably a lot of people were quite interested to see Broja,
yeah,
in there. Daniel, what did you make of that starting selection?
Yeah, I have to be honest, I wasn't too disappointed with it, other than Cucurella playing at left back, who I felt had a pretty shambolic performance at Old Trafford. I wanted to see Badiashil come back into the team because I was completely baffled that Badiashil didn't play against Man United. Mm. And Badiashil and Breuer in particular, the reason I wanted those two was just a physical point of view, especially against a direct team like Everton, and the sort of threat that I felt that Everton were going to pose. So in terms of when I looked at the lineup, I can't have too many complaints. I felt that on the left, because it was always clear that Cole Palmer was going to start on the right. I felt on the left it was a toss of a coin between Sterling and Mudryk. I think I may have gone with Sterling pre-match just because more experienced player has created and scored more so far this season. So you'd go with him over the more raw Mudryk. But yeah, I not even in hindsight, I can't turn around and go, oh, that lineup was shambolic, because I have to say I was pretty content with it.
I mean, it did look like, certainly when we started, it looked like, you know, round pegs in round holes, you know, that people were playing in their right positions. Regardless of what you say about Cucurella, he is a left back and he started there. And of course, Reece, you know, when Reece is fit and everything's working right, then he's clearly our number one right back. We started quite well. I thought we looked fairly lively. It did feel like there was more energy about the performance from the Man U game. And I think that is something that people wanted to see, if nothing else. They wanted to see a more coherent performance and a more, you know, a more dynamic performance than they had against Man U. And we certainly started like that. What do you... it seemed to me that it happened really fast, that when we got it got to the point where we were getting to the final third, and all of a sudden we couldn't find a pass, we couldn't pick out a run, we weren't moving into the right places. I mean, this and this is the thing I think that you were alluding to, you know, the Villa and the Forest game earlier in the season. You know, we lost those games, but we should never have lost those games. This one, it didn't feel like we were going to score. I mean, you know, even when we were kind of when we were sort of dominant in the game, it didn't feel really like we were going to score.
Yeah, I think the issue is especially, as many people pointed out, the style of opponent has felt kind of quite relevant to the type of Chelsea performance you're going to get. And especially tactically, what team you're coming up against. So at Brighton, a week before that Everton game, are going to press you, and Chelsea are able to play around that. And when we've got transitional players with speed that you can go very much out wide and find them and run into space, it's a lot better. And I think that that's where Chelsea look like they are becoming a better team under Pochettino. Mm. But as we've seen so many times, silly to say just this season, this has been the low block curse has been a problem for Chelsea for, you lose count, really. I mean, I'd say pretty much since, like, a serious problem since the last time we won the league title in 2017. And it does feel like when there is a side who are going to put bodies behind the ball, you are going to have players who are going to find inventive ways to create some trickery, to take a few risks, which I felt like there's an example earlier in the season against, say, Burnley, when we were 1-0 down, when you had Sterling, who looked incredible down the left wing and did take chances and got some luck because of that. We just didn't see that enough at the weekend. It feels like at the moment, Cole Palmer is the only player in this team who is going to try and play that audacious pass. And there is a risk behind that pass, and it can just go wildly wrong. But other than that, it did look pretty passive. And it looked to me like a team, especially in a final third, who had lost their edge, lost their confidence to even try things. And I do wonder if that is a sort of a build-up of the frustration of not getting results when we have played well so far this season. And that was a fear I had earlier in the season. If this keeps happening, will, despite all the nice numbers and stats we can throw up, psychologically, especially with a young group of players, is it going to dent their confidence? And well, I do worry that may have happened over the past week.
I think that's where the young thing comes in. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of chat this season, not least on this pod, about the fact, obviously, that the vast majority of the team, not only are they playing together for the first time, but they're also, you know, extraordinarily young. The vast majority of the new players are under the age of 23. But the point you were making about sort of, you know, audacious passes and people not finding each other, you know, I slightly worried because I look at these players and I think, yeah, they are young. And yes, they may have played in leagues prior to this that are perhaps not quite as high pressure as the Premier League. But, you know, you're talking about international players who are all costing, you know, upwards of 60 million, in some cases upwards of 100 million. And the lack of cohesion, the lack of a bit, it concerns me that they are unable to make the right run, find the right pass, you know, even only a couple of months, 3 months into the season, that we're still seeing that from players of the quality. And we know they have got quality of Enzo and Mudryk. And I'll take your point about Cole Palmer. He really does try to make a clever pass. And, you know, at the moment he's getting sort of 1 out of 8 or something. And, you know, he was also having a go, bless him. He was taking some shots on as well. And I think that's probably something that we've leaned into. But I think you make the training staff would have leaned into. But I think you make a really good point that actually the one thing where youth is might still be a factor is, it can get very easily for, it must be a lot easier for players to get dejected when things aren't going right. And I did feel like that was an issue. Do you also feel that, I mean, it can't but be a problem, but Reece going off, I mean, before we talk about Reece and, you know, where he stands and where he's going to go from here, I mean, just for the team after 20, 25 minutes or whatever it was, to lose your captain, a player who's just come back into the side, you know, already a bit of an icon in the side, that must have been also a pretty heavy blow, particularly when you have to start putting a left back at right back and putting a centre back at left back.
I'm not sure how much I put into that, mainly because Reece has not been a regular feature so far this season with this team. Like, we have had to play a lot of this season with either Mal Augusto playing there in the first few months of the season, because Reece, I think he only played the first game against Liverpool and then got injured, and then he wasn't back till the Brentford game, I think it was, at the end of October. So there has been a lot of time with this group of players without Reece James. And I don't know. It wasn't a career-ending injury. Like, it wasn't like a shocking injury that psychologically affects both sets of players. Like,
I'm thinking more about the psychological blow of losing someone who you'd have welcomed back into the team, who was also a regular, was also a big mainstay of, you know, a slightly more successful Chelsea from past times. That person, that kind of, and the personality, you know, his personality coming back into the team. So it's more that loss and the fact that he'd just come back. But I take your point. They have had to play without him an awful lot. I'm just looking for reasons as to why that confidence kind of falls away from us, why these very talented players, yes, young, but, you know, also relatively well-established players, aren't sort of playing with the cohesion that we have seen them play at occasionally.
Compounding pressure. It's the compounding pressure of okay, cool. The goals aren't going in at the start, and you know you feel you're almost there, and then when things keep going wrong and go from bad to worse, and you're yo-yoing results. You know, a great result, albeit a draw against City, and then a couple of shockers. It will eventually start creeping into your psyche and crushing that confidence, and then you're just not in that flow state, and it's worrying because we've got a lot of games coming up, and I don't know if what we can do to get out of this, and I don't know if Poch is the type of manager who will get people in under that siege mentality. I don't see him as the, and I'm not Poch out before anything. I don't see him as a Mourinho-esque manager who will, you know, pull Frank Lampard aside and tell him he's the best player in the world and make him believe he's the best player in the world and make him play to the abilities that he has. And I don't know if that's going to happen to Jackson over Christmas. Do you know what I mean?
Well, you know, you have to actually nearly be the best player in the world to believe that. And I'm not sure even Nicholas would believe that about himself. But anyway, so let's talk about Reece. I mean, clearly it's a crappy situation.
Can we sign his sister?
Yeah, transfer her in. Yeah. I mean, is it time that we now have to say to him? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of stuff going on social media, and I think there is a class of Chelsea fan who's possibly slightly misinterpreting other Chelsea fans who are saying, you know, we should offload him. And I think what they mean is, in fact, 9 times out of 10, they say, if we can't sort out this injury, then we need to offload him. That even might still be a bit harsh, but, you know, it pretty much has to be a case of, you know, keep him out for the long term. If surgery is deemed to be the thing that's going to improve things, take the surgery, son. You know, you're probably not going to make Euro 2024 now anyway. So it's got to be that, hasn't it? Because at the moment, we're just, you know, we're getting 10 or 12 games out of him, and that's just not enough.
Does surgery solve these hamstring injuries?
According to an article in The Athletic by a person who's an expert in these matters, it's not necessary. It should sort him out. It wouldn't necessarily stop these things coming back, but it should be a certainly a more long-term solution than just you know, just kind of the normal sort of, you know, 6 weeks recovery. Out. And yeah. Daniel, any thoughts on that?
It is it's an emotional subject as well, because I've had some backlash for what I've said, and I think people have misinterpreted what I've said as kind of quite careless or not showing sympathy to Reece James, and that's just far from the truth. But it's about having, I think, an honest conversation about the long-term evidence we have now, a lot of evidence of Reece James' injury problems over a number of seasons. Like, I think it's just quite staggering that Reece James has not played five successive Premier League games since May of 2022. So that's how long it's been since he has been fit, just for a small amount of time, not even a long period of time. And I do worry we're getting into an N'Golo Kante type situation with Reece, where when he returns, you're very much in a protective stance with him. And this is not a guy in his like late 20s, early 30s, where you can kind of logically see saving him for certain matches. This is a young, fit professional, or at least we'd hope would be a fit professional who is going into the prime years of his career, where he should be playing 30 games a season. And the fact he isn't, and the fact you're already in a situation where every couple of weeks he breaks down, I think there needs to be a serious conversation over, on the player side, yes, is surgery the right choice or not for him? There has been a conversation over a year now about this hamstring, because it's been a hamstring problem pretty much since, I think, before Christmas last year. So it's been a long-term thing for him. If that is the solution, and I think there's only really one solution, and he should be getting that injury, that surgery. But if it doesn't solve it, then what are you left with? Are you, yeah, I think from that more leaves it on the club side, where I think they then have to make a decision over trying to recruit maybe another fullback, someone who can
play both flanks.
Yeah, I mean, and I mean this goes back to Lewis Hall and especially Livramento, who, you know, at the time when we sold him, people were like, well, how's he going to make it through? But I remember even at the time saying, you know, Reece has got injury problems of his own, and he probably would get a lot of football at Chelsea, Livramento, if we'd kept him. So the shame of it is I just can't refer to Reece James. I personally have felt this for a while now. I don't think of Reece James as a key player anymore. I think he's almost like a cameo in a film at this point. You know, you're going to get him like 5-6 times a year. He'll pop up and probably put in an amazing performance, because that's the really heartbreaking thing, is you see this player when he's at his best, and there aren't many better. Just if you look at like pound for pound for their position, what they do to influence a team. But unfortunately, we spend seasons more without him than with him, and we spend a lot of time on shows, on podcasts, you know, talking about Reece James in potential. We don't sit here talking about him as a regular feature. And, you know, I know people were also having a go at me because I questioned giving him the captaincy. And it's not me saying strip Reece James of the captaincy. That's not my point. My argument, the logic of handing someone the captaincy who gets injured on a regular basis. Mm. Yeah, like, I know that you could argue, I looked briefly at Man City, for instance. So Kevin De Bruyne is their captain. Obviously, he has a lot of injury problems, but they do have other players around the squad who are there 9 times out of 10. And I personally still think that surely when you hand the armband to someone, the reason Conor Gallagher feels like a very natural fit is because he is a very durable player. And it's such a heartbreaking thing to think that Reece is going to go down, say, a Ledley King or Jack Wilshere route of always having these problems, and in years to come, we'll look back and go, oh, if it only had stayed fit. I pray that's not the case, but you know, I'm not a medical expert, you know, but it's just a very complex and very frustrating situation, yeah. I'm sure for him and for all of us as fans.
Well, I think we all do. And I think probably the reason that people are maybe a little quick to sort of jump up when they think that, you know, the likes of you and I or whoever are sort of, you know, are turning our back on him, that's far from the case, is because they know that when, you know, they can look back not too far back to when he and Chile were playing for us regularly, and they made a massive difference. They seem to make a massive difference to our side. So, you know, but him not being around, but also Chilwell not being available for so long, you know, it's a blow, because it seems that was when we were a much better side when those two were playing. Moving on a bit, let's have another look at a couple of other players. I mean, Mudryk. So I'm really glad he's had a few starts. And I really think that clearly, I mean, you would think, wouldn't you, from an 89 million quid player or whatever he is, who is a regular for his, well, I say regular, he's a new international, but he's an established international. You would think that he wouldn't need to, he wouldn't need so many games to play himself in. However, I do think there were signs. It was a mixture of a game for him, for, in my opinion. I thought there were moments where he's obviously got frightening pace. He did get round players. He was putting the ball into the box. Sometimes it was a good ball and no one could get on the end of it. Sometimes it was just a bad ball. He's a mixed bag. At the moment, I think somebody put something on Twitter about him. He looks like a kid who's overdosed on Haribo. And I thought that was quite a nice little thing, because he, there are times where you do think he does, you know, you think it's almost like his...
It's a dynamo.
His legs are working quicker than his mind. But I do think there's, you know, I do think there's a lot of good to come from him, and I hope we persevere with him. Mooch, where do you stand?
Yeah, I like him. He's not performing to the level that we need. It's frustrating. I do think he needs more starts. I think I sound like a broken record, but again, it's the confidence thing. You know, if you're trying to force it, it's not going to come. And he started well, and I think just as the game progressed and the frustration crept in, it was just trying too hard to make it happen, and it doesn't. I like the analogy. I think he's going to be great for us one day, but I just hope it's a Captain America sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? With what's the name?
Pulisic.
Yeah, like a Pulisic thing. It was just kind of, there was just flashes of it.
Yeah,
he's great. He's young still, and it just doesn't materialise.
Daniel, where do you stand on him?
I think I go back on back and forth on Mudryk. I think my frustration comes with investing so much on a player who is so raw, and we say we invest in potential a lot, but this really is investing on potential. You know, you can see it within him that this is a guy who just does not have a lot of experience. He is someone that's been thrown into a situation and into an environment that expects very quick results and is probably just too green for the current situation. And that doesn't mean that he can't utilize the skills that do make him a threat at the elite level. That's what makes him quite a most contradictory player, because you see some of his decision making, you think that's almost Timo Werner level bad, but then you look at some of his other traits and you think, I can see where the hype for him has come from, right? And I could see that in 2 to 3 years this could be one of the best wide players in the Premier League. I guess my frustration comes, if I'm more cynical, is why didn't we just keep Callum Hudson-Odoi? Because that, for me, as a player who is further down the line, I think technically is a more rounded player. And everyone talks about ceiling, right? And in like 5 years' time, Mudryk could be up here. And in 5 years' time, we don't know where Callum Hudson-Odoi is playing anymore, right? But it's, I guess that's kind of a wider conversation about Chelsea's investment and Chelsea's decision-making and buying young players from elsewhere when we actually could have invested in the talent we developed in our own academy. I know that's a side point, but I think in the case of Mudryk, it's, you've got him, you've invested in him, you have to play him, you have to give him time. He's never going to develop into anything if we don't see him play, get reps in, because he needs reps, because he hasn't had it in his career. So that's kind of what Chelsea we've invested in him, so you can't then turn around and go, well, he ain't performing. But it's like, well, you knew what you were buying.
Exactly. This is the drawback of the, you know, the long-term contracts, the 8-year contracts, although it allows us to buy these, you know, these up-and-coming talents that otherwise we might not be able to afford by amortizing over these long periods. It's, you know, you're absolutely dependent on them building on the promise that they've shown, And in some cases, that's clearly not going to happen. You know, it's just not, it just ain't going to happen for every single one that we buy, every single 20, 21 year old that we buy over an 8 year period. They're not all going to become, you know, the next Messi. And I think you made a very good point about Callum, you know, the Callum Hudson-Odoi thing. I think Callum's ceiling probably is lower than Mudryk's, but, you know, we ain't ever going to see what Mudryk's ceiling is unless we give him those games. And maybe in this team, it's we're never going to see it anyway because he won't get the confidence quickly enough. So another thing I thought about in the aftermath of the game was that there was a lot of chat about Everton, you know, wanting it more or being more up for it or any of that kind of stuff. And I'm not really sure that was the case, but I mean that's another thing that's part of that whole. You know, we're a little bit young, we're a little bit naive. I mean. It's a bit of a concern. We should have, even if we haven't got the nous and the experience, surely this team has the ability to do better in the final third than it does.
You would think so, but we're halfway through the season and it's just, we're seeing the same thing over and over again. And I think it's a personnel change that needs to happen for us to sort of start seeing some sort of spark up front, and hopefully that personnel change sparks a bit of a confidence and rubs off on some of the players around that striker or that number nine, whoever it may be in January, and we start getting goals from not just this brand new striker, but from our sort of supporting wingers and tens.
Yeah.
I don't see any. It's not going to magically change.
No.
Over the next before the new year, I don't. I'd like to see more from Broja, but I don't think that's going to happen. This season, I think you know he's still kind of. There's a player there, but I don't know if he's the answer that we need right now. And maybe this is indicative of what Chelsea do. You know, we might have a player who could be perfect for it and we just don't give him the chance. But I mean,
it's an interesting point. There was I think it was Football London or one of those, or it might have been, I don't know, one of those sites put out a story that... there were seven players that we're considering getting rid of. Trevor Chalobah, who I think we all know is on his way out, unfortunately. Martsen, who might also be a prime suspect. But then Nonni, Madueke, Cucurella, Di Zarzi and Malo Gusto, which strikes me as absolutely insane, and Broja. Now, I'm assuming this is all working on the basis that I don't know if this is someone getting putting two and two together and making five, but I'm assuming it's all on the basis that with things changing, with financial rules changing and us, you know, having to keep an eye on our finances anyway, this is about clearing space for a possible new biggish name signing to come in, possibly as a, you know, possibly a number nine, one of the number nines that have been touted as coming to our way. Daniel, do you think there's any veracity in those rumours? I mean, I can't imagine that anyone would be 100% safe, particularly if the Conor Gallagher rumours are also true. But, you know, what is your view on all of these? What's your view on Broja? What's your view on the other names that are being bandied about?
I think there is just a kind of cynical approach that the club know from an FFP point of view, and this was something that the previous ownership capitalized on as well. When you sell an academy player, it's pure profit, which obviously helps in terms of FFP, even though I'd say a majority of the time I don't think it's helped. Actually, I think that's kind of a very simplistic way of looking at your academy graduates, especially when a lot of those have proven to be some of the most consistent and mature players over the past 5 years. I mean, as 100%. You said, why buy Axel Di Zarzi and Malo Gusto and these players, unless, you know, I've at times tried to sort of dismiss these kind of American the American kind of slander that's been thrown Todd Bowley's way, you know, in terms of people just thinking that because he's an American and there is American influence over our ownership, that they want to turn everything into American sport. Because I think that's a very simplistic way of looking at it, especially with the sort of money that was involved in Chelsea, in buying Chelsea in the first place. But, you know, you do think about the American, and the Dodgers just did another massive trade for players, and trading is a massive part of American sport in comparison to what we do over here, where we have the transfer windows, and it's not quite the same approach. Like, yeah, the idea of just quickly trading players, especially for the sort of fees and wages that players are on in this country and in European football in general, is not, yeah, a simple thing. So I can't see that massive churn of players once again. And I just think another massive turnover in January, even if it was feasible, how does that help anyone? You know, yeah, because it's exactly been so... It's the turnover. It's incredible. Actually, someone, I don't know if you saw this, someone online posted a clip, because it was 2 years to the day, I think, this like on the 11th, since that 3-2 win over Leeds at Stamford Bridge. And it was about the scuffle at the end. And there's only two players remaining from that squad, and that's Thiago Silva and Reece James. What other club has gone through that extreme turnover of personnel on the pitch, off the pitch, you know, whatever it is? And to just go through that again, I think it'd be a nonsense. I just want to be a bit, when I read the line internally, there are some suggesting that selling Conor Gallagher could still be a good idea. I mean, if I was in any sort of relevant position of power at Chelsea, I'd sack the person suggesting that.
100%.
It's the idea that selling Conor Gallagher improves Chelsea is an absolute nonsense. I mean, it's the classic short-term reactive chasing your tail Chelsea approach, that because if we sell Conor Gallagher now, in 2 weeks time we'll get someone who looks more flashy, but then in a year's down the line, why did we sell Conor Gallagher? You know, we've been through this so many times, it's so tiring.
100%. I mean, and the thing is, you know, you can see it, you can certainly see it, you know, some of the academy graduates that aren't playing very much or have played a bit and haven't really kind of taken the bit between their teeth, possibly. But, you know, the fact that Connor is still being mooted as a potential, you know, one for the exit door seems absolutely insane. And but it's those same people who we're in 100% agreement about that. But those same people who are saying that that is a terrible thing and we shouldn't get rid of Connor, a lot of those same people in the same breath are saying that we should get rid of Poch. I mean, there's an insane amount of stuff on social media saying Poch out, or, you know, and while I don't think he is absolutely 100% blame free for what's going on at the moment, I don't understand the thinking behind that, because, you know, whoever you get in, they're going to, is what you were saying about, you know, change, is what you were saying about more churn. Why would we want more churn in a managerial position? I mean, it's even bigger shooting ourselves in the foot, surely.
I think if you look at the Arsenal situation and how they have stuck by Arteta through some rough patches, some poor seasons, and allowed him to sort of really put his mark on a team, we're going to have to do the same thing. We've got a good manager who knows his stuff, who can get this team playing. We've got a crop of fresh young talent who he may or may not have quite his stamp of authority over, and, you know, it may not be exactly his team, but there's elements there that of players that he wants, and it's just be cutting your nose off to spite your face to have a massive reshuffle of the management and coaching staff or the players, which is harder to do in January. So I can't see that being but then this is Chelsea. You never know, like, you never know what can happen. But I pray that we don't do anything rash.
Daniel, what's the next step forward for you? Where do you think, what is the one obvious thing that needs to happen in the next few weeks, at least, that Poch and the players actually do have some control over?
Well, I think you have to look at the upcoming fixtures as an opportunity rather than a curse. Like, there is an opportunity when you look at the quality pound for pound of who we're coming up against. Sheffield United, Wolves, got Newcastle in the League Cup quarter final. That's a chance to get within touching distance of another cup final, which I think maybe is, as I think maybe we discussed at the start of the pod, it's kind of a little bit, that's becoming maybe the big narrative of this season is going to be the cup competitions, the big saviours of this season. And then you've got Crystal Palace and Luton. So you end the year, and it sounds farcical at the moment because I think a lot of people maybe rightly, especially if you look at the calendar year of 2023, Chelsea, I think have got 39 points from 39 Premier League games. And I think pound for pound or points per game, we're the worst team in the Premier League this year.
If you don't count the teams that have come up or the teams that got relegated, yeah.
So there is a reality, despite I'm very much of the belief that, yeah, sacking another head coach is only going to create more problems. In the short and long term, what head coach of any relevance and significance and quality is going to want to come to Chelsea?
100%.
Given the turnover, the reaction of sacking Pochettino and Poch out and all of this stuff. I mean, at this point, I'm not surprised because there is, especially maybe younger generation, or just Chelsea fans in general, have been conditioned to think that that is the only solution to everything. So it's just like it's a gag reflex. It's like it's the one solution that people think is going to solve everything because they've seen it so many times. My only confusion about that is if it's almost like people have completely wiped from their memory what happened last season, where we did change the head coach not once but twice. I mean, I'm not counting Bruno, unfortunately. I feel sorry for the bloke, but we're not counting him.
He's one game.
But, you know, to change it multiple times and to not see a radical improvement in results and performances and just our fortune, I think should tell you a lot that strategy simply isn't working anymore. So I do think there's that, but there also is just a harsh reality for Pochettino as any coach at this level is you can't keep on losing games and just expect to stay in a job. Arteta is very lucky in the 2020-21 season when he had them near the relegation zone that I think most clubs would have sacked their head coach, but eventually he found wins, and that's what Pochettino has to find. And I'm not saying that Pochettino has to revert to really short-term methods and just throw away any of the progressive plans he had in the summer. I don't think that's, I actually think it's going the opposite direction. I think it's maybe returning to things that he was doing in pre-season that I think excited us. Part of that is obviously going to be the return of Christopher Nkunku, or really the start of Christopher Nkunku's Chelsea career, which I think could make a huge difference. It's easy to forget that Romeo Lavia is even a Chelsea player because we haven't seen any of him. I think these things will hopefully create an upturn. And I always, even though I have been more nihilism FC is the way I've referred to Chelsea this year, they do want to sort of beat the optimism out of you. But I think it is quite obvious they have to start putting wins on the board. They have to start building that momentum. And you'd hope that the quality and confidence that we have seen I think it'd be stupid and simplistic to say nothing has been good at all this season. Everything has been dire. I know the table doesn't reflect all of the positives, but there have been positives this season, as we've discussed, and why it's been so frustrating and bewildering at times. They've got to start winning bankable games. Chelsea have to start winning bankable games. It can't just be turn up against Man City and Liverpool, because that's not the majority of our games.
I mean, I think the thing is that, you know, we can look at Poch and say, you know, there's been a couple of questionable, particularly in-game decisions. But generally speaking, he's been dealt a particularly shitty hand, and but the thing that you do always say is, you know, any new manager, let's say for the sake of argument that they did want to get rid of him and they brought in a new manager, any new manager is going to have the same set of problems, which is the same ownership, same sporting directors, same squad, same bunch of players who have really only been playing together for 5 minutes, you know. Having said that, you are right. This is Chelsea. We are playing teams where really we should be taking a few points. And more to the point, you would expect a manager of Poch's pedigree to start getting a tune out of the team. So, I think he's got I think, and I hope he's got a fair bit of time, but you're absolutely right. You know, he can't just, it can't go on being like this. He's got to drag us up by our bootstraps.
I also just want to say I read quite a few months before he actually became Chelsea head coach. I read Brave New World, which was Gillian Balague's book around Pochettino, about his time at Spurs. And a lot of it is kind of framed in Pochettino's own words. And he speaks about the first few months of his time at Spurs and how things were starting to go a little bit awry. And it didn't look like they were going in a positive direction. And he was sort of stood on the touchline. I think they were losing 1-0 away at Villa, a very different Villa side to the one now. And he was kind of like, we're going to be sacked in the morning, basically. And then Harry Kane stepped up, I think, with an incredible free kick. And, you know, at times there is, of course, that speaks to, we talk about tactics and philosophy so much, but at times it's just individual moments of brilliance that changes football games. That's always been the case and always will be. So maybe there is a sense of that, of something needs to go in Chelsea's favour. And I did think that Brighton would maybe be that game, because we didn't play incredibly well against Brighton, but we were able to grind out a really important win. So I think there's a bit of that. There also was in that story from Pochettino at the start of his Spurs career, was he realized that he had to stick to his principles and not waver from them. And sorry to bring up Graham Potter, but I feel that the opposite happened with him. My instinct or my belief is that Potter, for the first 10 games of his Chelsea career, was doing what he believed in. And then the moment that Brighton defeat happened, it looked like to me he got scared and started to go away from that for whatever reason. So maybe there is a bit of that, and maybe the fortune of having an amazing player like Christopher Nkunku does make a huge difference, just as having an amazing player like Harry Kane makes a huge difference. So fortune and quality, but Chelsea have to find a way to make 2024 better. I mean, we can't have another year of just dismal joylessness. You know, there has to be something to cling on to. Because at the end of the day, if he keeps losing, every football club, no matter how fundamental or structural we think the problems are, there will come a point where decisions get made.
Someone has to go. Yeah. And he's going to be the easiest one to get rid of. I hope it doesn't come to that. I hope they give him plenty of time. And I hope he gets the luck that he deserves and we all want our club to have. Daniel, you're going to be joining us again on our preview. We're going to have a preview chat about the Sheffield United game. So until then, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mooch, good to talk to you again, as ever, mate. We'll see you for the preview chat.
Catch a bit.
Take it easy. Keep the blue flag flying high, folks.
If you want to advertise on or sponsor this show, check us out at playbackmedia.co.uk.
Sports Social Podcast Network.